Welcome to The Ether. Today is Thursday, March 31st, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the lunatic community. Visit OC's What We Do page using the link in the show notes to take advantage of some of their other educational resources, including weekly meetups to discuss Terra protocols, strategies, and concepts, the Terra Luna Intel Report on Telegram, and YouTube explainer videos on Terra concepts. You can also support their community efforts by considering them next time you're delegating or redelegating your Luna. Find out more at orbitalcommand.io. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Luart. Luart is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. Luart provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in the Discord server for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, a CeFi space, MMO war stories. Let's take a listen.
For like 10 years, just like basic UI updates. But yeah, it's a map. It's like a, I don't know how to explain the point of view. It's slightly top down, but it's tilted because there's two teams on either side of the map, so it tilts whichever way that you're playing from. So there's a red and blue side, and red is you're playing from the right side, and blue is you're playing from the left side. So you're going from left, you're like left side of your, I mean, bottom left corner to top right corner, where red is going from top right corner to bottom left corner, if that makes sense.
So no, but League is a game where, like, if you started today, do you have to be decked out with a bunch of equipment and stuff, or you just sort of just start playing?
No, there's no like pay to earn aspect to it at all. There's only skins. You can just start playing. You have to be level 30 in order to even play ranked. So there's a pretty hefty learning curve to the game. There's a lot to it. There's like 170 champions now. Each champion has four separate abilities, a passive ability. Some champions have like crazy abilities that allow them to take over other champions and use their abilities. So a lot of the knowledge and mechanics come from just knowing about how the champions function.
Yeah, of course, like all the different permutations and whatnot in the game. Yeah. Yeah, I knew it was like a really long-standing popular game, League of Legends. I just I never touched it to sort of, well, part of it was like, after getting over the addiction of one MMO, I was like, I don't know, like, you know, there comes a point you're like, wait a minute, it's like, you know, you got to decide like how much time to spend on these things. So more lately, like I haven't tried to get too involved with MMO style games, like maybe a brief foray into World of Warcraft to see what was going on a number of years ago. But I didn't like mess with it again because it's just so all encompassing.
Oh, yeah. It's like all or nothing. You really need to spend time and learn the game if you want to actually enjoy it, because there's a certain skill level that you need in order to have fun. Otherwise, you're just going to get destroyed.
It's not even a question. Like, yeah, there's also a matter of like your personality too. Mm-hmm. Like, if you tend to play a game and you only enjoy it because you intend to sort of quote unquote beat it, and you want to play at the top of the game with MMOs, that's what sucks you in, right? So once you're playing like with guilds and groups, and you're scheduling your life around when those events happen and shit like that, that's when you know it's the time commitment becomes much more extraordinary when it's not just like casual. You're showing up, playing for a little while, and then exiting, right? You're actually like scheduling your actual life events around that shit. You're like, oh, well, you know, I would go on a trip next week, but there's this event happening, right?
Game like, that I need to play on Saturday.
Exactly. So yeah, it becomes problematic. The other thing is like, it's one thing when you're younger and you don't have kids.
Yeah.
And then it's like later you're like, wait a minute, hold on. Is this like, this is the role model for your kids is like the fucking gaming dad, right? Like just playing all day long.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm still pretty young. Like I'm probably younger than half of your age.
Yeah, probably so. Well, I'm like late 40s now. So just to give you a reference, but yeah, but you know, it was different because when I was playing, you know, like I literally played from when video games began, right? Like Pong to freaking like Atari games to Pac-Man to like every layer after that. And, you know, some of the original, like almost like RPG style games were made by Sierra. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember those, but like, or we're old enough, but there was like Space Quest and Leisure Suit Larry and like King's Quest and whatever. And that sort of like began the sort of like bringing the RPG style, you know, pen and paper type games into reality. And then, of course, like later D&D made a whole series, Dungeons and Dragons made a whole series of games. And they were all like single player style games. And then like, but it definitely got your imagination sparked back then for like what games were going to be then. Later, I think one of the really first big MMOs was really Ultima Online, where you brought like the fantasy features in and you kind of really had a really great game. And then I didn't get heavy into that one. Like, I don't know why. Maybe I think it was just because of time, actually. At the time, I was at some of my busiest academically and stuff. Yeah. And then my academic time, like, opened up and I was like, hey, I got more time to play. And that's when EverQuest first came out. And you know what it's like when you first get into a game?
It's you eat, breathe, and sleep the game. It's just
imagine, but remember when you first get in and it's like that's when the game was released, right? You're like an OG. Yeah. That's different, right? Because you have so much alpha because you've been playing this from the very beginning. Yeah. Like you like and the people you meet are also the people that have all that alpha and know how to play the game at a level. And some of the times it happens is some of those early players are beta testers in games and stuff. So they know just enough to get ahead of everyone else. And
that's kind of how it was with League. Like if you got in early into League, like season one or season two, there were only about like 30 champions, I think, or maybe 25. So it was much easier to learn those champions, learn the meta, get good. And then they would release a new champion every like 4 to 5 months, I believe.
How many are there now in that game?
Oh, like 180, I think.
Oh, shit. So like just figuring out the nuances of all these things is really tough.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you started early, you were able to kind of learn them slowly as they came out. But like if you were to go to start now, it's insane. Like how much?
Yeah, the same problem happens. Like, for example, if you were to just show up in like a World of Warcraft today. Even if you knew how to play your own character, you don't necessarily know what all the other characters do, right? Yeah. Because if you were in the very beginning, right? If you're in the very beginning when it first comes out, you understand like, okay, what are the limitations of a warrior? And so therefore, if you're like a cleric character in some game, like it's more obvious like what you're supposed to be doing because you know the features and capabilities of all the other teammates. As well as the opponent, right? Exactly. But when you just show up and everyone else knows like all the other meta, you know, gaming issues, and then you just show up, you're just like stuck having this huge compendium of shit you have to know.
Yeah.
And that is like a barrier of entry in many ways to actually like the new players.
Yeah. It's really bad. Like the list of like unknown unknowns over time when these games like don't create secondary versions and they just keep updating. There's so many.
Yeah, exactly. The unknown unknowns gets to be infinity is what you're saying. It's sort of like the same
thing. Idea what the game is actually like.
Yeah. It's like that in DeFi too. Like take, for example, like when almost nothing was available on Terra, like last, you know, May, you know, you had Anchor and, you know, almost maybe Terra Swap and what else, like almost nothing else. Everything else showed up. It was actually way easier to kind of figure out the mechanics one by one of each protocol, because you kind of understood where that next puzzle piece fit in the next, like, you know, next part of the strategy that you're going to put forth. But when, like, you're having a spaces and people are discussing strategy and we're all jumping around from one protocol to the other, talking about this, talking about that, like, it's hard for the newcomer. They're like, what? Like,
why are you doing that?
You know what I mean? Like, it's why are you doing that? And that's part of the reason why I don't jump around to different, like, blockchains and things, only because, like, once you have enough knowledge about, you know, in depth with one of them, right, where you know all the mistakes that you can make, you know, all the different, like, ways you can get liquidated, or, you know, what are all the different opportunities for your Luna or whatever it is, right? That game becomes much more straightforward, and you don't have to spend as much time playing the game. And we could just, like, bullshit here, right? Like, because that was one of the things too in EverQuest. I remember, like, you could spend more time socializing in relationship to the game when you knew all the nuances, because you weren't stressed out about, like, oh, you know, we're gonna have to beat this thing, and I'm supposed to be performing at a certain level and I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, so therefore I'm gonna wreck it for everybody else, right? It's way more stressful in that way. And I remember when I first, like, tried World of Warcraft much later, again, this is way after it started, like many years, and I got that itch to go play MMOs again, and I was like, let's check this out. And then I was like, man, I not only am I not playing at the level that I used to play in EQ, and I know that, like, I'm capable of that, but there was no sort of obvious group to teach you to get to where you need to go, right? So you could do your own research, you can figure out all the game mechanics, you could try to, like, look up, I don't know what, like, you know, what, you're going to go to forums and read up on all, like, the things about
YouTube guides and stuff like that.
Yeah, go to guides and all this garbage. But, like, it just wasn't the same thing, right? Like, it was just, it just seemed like work at that point, right?
Yeah.
Whereas when you got to discover the game from the very beginning, that was sort of, like, the key. That's why, like, anytime a new game comes out, it makes sense to try to get in right at the very beginning.
Yeah, immediately, like, buy it on release and play the absolute crap out of it until you know it. And then you're already way ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, because, you know, like, people say, oh, I just want to play and this and that. But, like, realistically, like, most people prefer to win. Like, it doesn't matter if it's DeFi.
Exactly. Like I have fun winning. Like, I don't know how people have fun losing. There's a certain, like, skill level that you need in order to really enjoy a game.
Yeah, it's the same thing, like, in DeFi. Like, if you're making money and you're ahead, or not DeFi, just in general, like, crypto trading, it doesn't matter what it is. Like, if you're ahead and you're way in the green and you're 20x your initial principal, and you're doing well, and you can sort of, like, play in this and gamble in that and just monkey around, it's just a different sort of level. It feels the same way diving into a system. Like it would just, like, 7 years after something comes out. That's partly why the DeFi space gets so tribal too, if you think about it, because it really is a significant barrier to entry to a new system to learn all the nuances of it. Right. Like, I mean, just think about it. Like, why did I, like, you know, like, imagine using your Terra Station wallet, right? You click a button and sometimes, you know, the transaction doesn't go through and you're like, oh, fuck. So you go and, like, close out your Terra Station app, and then you go and, restart your, you refresh your screen. Even those basic mechanics, you eventually figure out, okay, I figured out what's going on here.
It becomes mindless. It's not, like, stressful.
Right.
But when you go to it, it's not a problem.
Yeah, but you go to a new thing and you go and have to learn all those stupid nuances. Right? Like, it's like work at that point.
I remember when I went to Phantom, and I don't know if you have too much experience with Phantom, but there's an issue with Phantom locking up MetaMask sometimes. And I was so stressed out the first time that it happened, because it locked up my ledger and I couldn't trade for, like, 3 or 4 days. I had no idea what was going on, but it was just a simple setting that you had to go into MetaMask and change. And after that, like, I could fix it within, like, a few minutes.
Right, but, like, that first time you had to figure it out is just painful, right? Or, like, if you haven't been liquidated on Anchor Protocol or something, right? Like, you know, you don't even know how quickly it can happen. You haven't sort of watched the mechanics at play.
Yeah, exactly.
And so once you get comfortable with it, it's just different. What's that?
You're like blowing my mind with this comparison. I've never thought of like DeFi in this way, like comparing it to games. But like the comparison of like how there's hundreds of protocols now on all of these chains. If we just got in a few years earlier, there was only one or two to play around with, and you could learn them gradually as they came out, and it wasn't like an information and sensory overload at the time. But
on the other hand, the gaming history like does teach you something, and that is, you know what, a lot of the content in games is mostly fluff and to just sort of like entertain you for a little while, right?
Yeah.
But you didn't have to go to every single piece of content in, you know, an Evercrest or a World of Warcraft or whatever the hell. You just didn't have to go to everything to make do well, right? Like, and at some point what happens is your team decides to go to the highest yielding, like whatever you can spend the amount of, if you're going to spend a whole group's worth of time, right? You end up going to the place that gets you the highest net benefit for the group at any given moment. And it's not that different in DeFi in that there's a lot of stupid protocols that are probably useless. And yeah, you might play around with them, throw $100 here and there and, you know, try to win the lottery. But realistically, like you're not going to deploy a serious amount of your time, energy, or like research time or build the experience necessary to utilize those things the way that, you know, you otherwise could, right? So that's kind of the realization from the gaming, I think, that you wind up seeking out efficiency ultimately at some level.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because I know in some games, like growing up, I was always the person to try to find like the easiest and best way to make the most in-game currency, or like in Skyrim, the little glitches and stuff that you can do to increase your skill levels. I would always go and find those things, and it almost feels like that in DeFi, like trying to find those protocols that are going to get me to where I want to be the fastest.
Because you're kind of thinking like a min-maxer essentially, right? You're trying to find the minimum amount of time it takes, the max amount of effect.
Exactly.
And like which stats, like, you know, whether it's like a Diablo 3 or whatever it is, like well-designed game creates like lots of different trajectories where you like put together this set of Lego blocks. And then once you have that set up, like you can do really cool, you know, like you're looking for the synergies basically, right? Like, hey, if I get this skill and that skill and this thing, how are those going to combine to form like a more powerful character to beat such and such, right? And why am I beating that thing? Because I want that particular item that is also synergistic with what I'm doing, that kind of thing. Yeah. So, but the game designers are real explicit when they do that. Whereas in the DeFi space, it's somewhat true, right? But it's not quite so integrated yet.
It's not quite there. I feel like there's a big disconnection with a lot of protocols that are coming out, and they're not necessarily working with each other as much as they could be. There's, especially in Phantom, maybe not in Terra yet, but in Phantom, there's so many protocols that are doing the same thing. Whereas if they just either teamed up or made their protocols function together, there is a lot of value there.
Like, I'll give you an example. Like, so many people like to play like leverage on Anchor, right? Like they like to go in there and like borrow and, you know, go do other stuff with their borrowed money. So you have to have access to some amount of like bonded Luna to do this, right? So the bonded Luna, it surprises me, given how much bonded Luna is out there. It surprises me that there are not more protocols that allow you to simply deposit your bonded Luna. They take your yield and you can dollar cost average into it, like a whatever coin you want, right? Isn't that weird? Don't you think it's like, if there's so many people going in and out of bonded Luna in order to borrow and that such, it makes it, it makes sense for that to be a possible deposit to buy whatever the heck you want, so that if you are like, you need to go and manage your LTV, now you can take your bonded Luna and then you can go and put it back and do so with no problem, right? And so that type of gamification, like, it seems like for some reason in the, when people are building the various protocols, they don't, they're not thinking enough like the video game concept, right? Like, they're not thinking of the synergies where, hey, you know, a person that likes to borrow is going to need their bonded Luna, and they're going to need it on a whim, right? If like the your LTV is changing, hey, I need to take that bonded Luna out of Nexus. I need to park it over here, or I need to take it out of whatever, like whatever protocol. But at the same time, like while you're sitting idle and I'm like, hey, you know what? I want to be able to take my bonded Luna and I want to be able to buy the cheapest coin that I can today, right? Like maybe I want my yield to go towards getting Astra tokens or something, right? If like you have the ability to move that piece around to where you can get what you want when you want it and then still have it available to manage LTV, that would be awesome.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I feel like there's a lot of development on big changes where they rush and focus on these large new ideas, but there's not a lot of time focused on user experience and quality of life changes that would.
Yeah, quality of life is the right word, actually. Because remember, yeah, like in gaming, there were remember all those different items that would drop in different games that literally were for quality of life?
Yeah. Like Diablo and like item filters and stuff like that.
Yeah. Another quality of life item would be like games where, you know, you start with a backpack and it only holds like 10 items, but then like you go along and you can make one that can hold like 20 items.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that would be more of a quality of life. They didn't make it impossible to get it, but they wanted to make it such that, like, you know, the effect is not like overpowering from the perspective of winning the game. Mm-hmm. It just made it easier to like live.
Yeah, exactly. And you learn a little bit about the game as you go, and then you can learn that you can make bigger bags, different types of bags, stuff like that. But yeah, I think that there's like a lack of focus on user interfaces and experiences in the space, even just like different strategies. Like the communities know that we do all of these different strategies, but why are there not buttons and different ways to like execute these strategies? Like these
I think protocols would just make more money, first of all.
Like, exactly. It makes it so much quicker.
For example, if like, let's say on an NFT platform, I'm like interested in maybe buying some NFTs, but like I just want my bonded Luna yield to go to buying them, right? Mm-hmm. So all I got to do is like I got to park my bonded Luna on, you know, whatever marketplace for a while. That yield goes and automatically maybe gets me some like points or whatever you want to call it to get myself some NFTs. But maybe if I did that, and the longer you lock your, say, bonded Luna there, maybe it creates like you gamify it to where like you get a greater number of points. It's almost like the amps concept with Prism or something like that, where you get more value by parking it there because the protocol's like you're guaranteeing that yield for a period of time, right, to that protocol. So by doing so, it's almost like frequent flyer miles. You're getting a greater benefit, and you could buy more NFTs for having locked it up for a longer period of time or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you don't see too much of that with the utility from these primitives, which is kind of strange.
No, there's really not much. There is one protocol I won't go there yet. One thing that, this is like my biggest gripe in the DeFi space is profit and loss. Why the hell does every protocol not have profit and loss built in somewhere? I know Mars does now on their pools, but why is it not an adopted like metric?
What do you mean? Like your personal profit loss or?
Yeah, like profit and loss of your current position. So say you're farming like Luna B Luna.
Oh, yeah.
Like why does it not display your most recent profit loss, even if it resets when you re-enter the position? Like that's what Mars protocol does, but Mars is like the only one that I've seen that does that.
It does make sense because you're already connecting your wallet. It already knows what transactions.
It knows the cost basis. It knows everything about the position. There's no reason they can't add that.
Yeah, that's a great point, because then you don't have to sit there and like, hey, wait a minute, I put in 30,000 here.
I don't have to sit here on Google Sheets trying to write formulas to automatically calculate it with me.
No, there's plenty of times where I'm like, I buy something, I'm like, okay, I got it pretty cheap, but I just don't remember after the fact like what I bought it at. It's
you have no idea. Yeah, it's just like a gauge. You have no idea what the exact value dollar. It is. And there are some tools that help with that. Like there's DBank, I think Zapper, but even those aren't the best. Like DBank doesn't cover the Terra chain, and it's difficult for them to add the chain. I don't know why. It's been voted on multiple times, but they haven't added it. And that doesn't necessarily give you profit loss, but that allows you to track your portfolio value much easier. And I don't know. It's like the first thing I noticed when I hopped into DeFi. It's like, where is profit loss? This is so difficult to calculate on my own.
Or for that matter, that would be true too of like NFTs as well, I suppose. Like, where's your record of, well, you could go back to the original like transaction hash or whatever, but like, where's your record of how much you paid for this thing?
Exactly. So and you have to really go look at the floor price to see how much it's worth now, rather than just looking at your portfolio wherever and seeing the price right there.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't record it in your, like, I think the acquisition price would be obvious, like even in your wallet to do that function, but it doesn't do that either.
No.
You just see your NFT and that's it.
Yeah, I think that could be like a big factor holding DeFi back in the long term regarding big money moving in. Because I mean, in TradFi, as soon as you enter a position, you see exactly how much you're making, and it refreshes every 5 seconds. And I feel like that's a huge part of the TradFi protocols in DeFi that needs to be implemented. For example, like Dopex and the options protocols and the centralized trading protocols and stuff like that, I feel like that needs to be added.
Yeah. No, we're creating this. The same scenarios happening in like the DeFi space as sort of happened in gaming, in that, like, after a while you realize, hey, wait a minute, there's only a certain number of types of classes of character I can build in like into a RPG. There's only a certain number of ways to skin a cat in terms of attack and defense, and there's only so many ways to like make more money out of money. And there's no question, like, the ecosystem of TradFi, DeFi, you know, it like, how many different financial inventions can you create to sort of like redirect yield or whatever? At some point, like, all the permutations get created, and that's why I'm still not really clear, like, why you need, you know, what is specific about each individual like blockchain, for example. Like, what makes one so distinct from the other that it matters? And that's what's interesting to me about Terra, is that like the like UST mechanism, all else being equal, right? Like, assuming everything else in your chain is exactly as good as Terra, not having that extra like piece of equipment, so to speak, or that capability for the class, like in a video game, it just makes it like just not as good. And then the question is, okay, well, can you add that feature to other chains, or is that integral to that chain's function? And then at that point, it's like, well, okay, now you just have like all the other things that this chain can do, except it can't do that one thing. And that, I don't know, it makes it hard for that like class to survive in video game concept theory.
Yeah, it's like there's Call of Duty and there's Battlefield for first person shooters, and like in DeFi, those are the two chains that are surviving. And there's so many other first person shooters that have come around, but they haven't survived because they're just mimicking. They're not really changing anything. And
yeah, what's that feature? Because you know, how many features are there in computing, right? Speed, scalability, security. It's like the trilemma situation, essentially. And you can like create a million ways to, you can only create so many permutations of how to skin that cat, right? It's like nine combinations of that or something like that.
Yeah, no, completely. Yeah, I had a friend who I was trying to get into DeFi, and he asked me that. That was like one of his first questions. He's like, what is the difference between these chains if they all are mimicking like traditional finance? They're all offering borrowing and lending. They're all offering NFTs. They all have some kind of game, and they all have some kind of like store of value. Like, what is the difference between these chains? And I didn't even have a good answer. It's just whichever one you like the best.
Yeah, or like whichever one you happen to join first, right? It's like the video game problem. Like you guys mentioned a variety of games that sounded like really interesting, but I hadn't played them only because like I didn't have the fortitude to go and like try all these other different platforms and you know, like, and figure them out, because I was like, well, if I already have a system that I love in a particular game and you enjoy that and it gets that dopamine hit for you, there's not an obvious reason necessarily to seek out lots and lots of different experiences automatically, right? Like, in other words, you find something that fits your niche. Same thing, like inside of a game, same thing, right? Like, imagine you're in an MMO and you're like, you know what? I really prefer to play the, you know, magic classes. I really prefer to play the warrior class. I prefer to, right? Because depending on the mechanics in that game, your quality of life and your lifestyle in the game differs based on the class, if the game is built well enough, right?
Yeah.
So you find out what you like, and then you don't necessarily automatically go and play a warrior next time. I think most people that play MMOs, I'll bet you, if you, like people in this room, like most people will play the same character over and over again. Mm-hmm. Like they'll go to different games, but they'll like seek out the rogue character,
exactly,
like in Skyrim, or they'll seek out the sniper character like in Fallout, or they'll seek
out. Like, I always, every, no matter like what game I play, I always end up leaning towards like the ranged character, like the just damage ranged character, no matter what it is and or what game it is.
Right. Yeah. That, so like you tend to have this like, this personality that regardless which game you play, you tend to be the same personality. Like no matter how many times I say to myself, you know what, I'm going to play the like melee tank warrior class this time, right?
Yeah.
And then like then you get to the character creation screen and you're like, I'm just gonna play the
fun.
I'm just gonna play the rage character again.
I don't want to do that. It looks stupid.
It's like in Fallout, like I bet you play like the ranged, you know, you'd play the ranged stealth character, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. You just try to max out like pistols or something.
Yeah, or max out the like sniper rifles, things of that nature.
Yeah.
There's that for some. Yeah, there's something about our personalities that we do tend to gravitate towards similar. There are some people that like to play every character in a game. Like they really like to understand the mechanics of them all. There are some games that like tend to favor that. Like, for example, like Diablo 3 is an example of this, because you get so much equipment and eventually you're like, shit, I'm finding like really good equipment for other characters. I need to do something with this shit. So then you make another class just to like hold all this extra equipment at first, and then later you're like, okay, fine, I'll play the Witch Doctor or whatever the hell it is, right?
Yeah, I play another game it's similar to Diablo, but it's on Steam. It's called Path of Exile, and it has this like crazy complicated skill tree that has like a billion different combinations that you can do. So it's super difficult to make something that's not unique. But when you end up playing the game, you end up having to create multiple characters in order to take advantage of the drops that you get, and in order to
arm the game sort of sucks you into those other.
Yeah, exactly. And you need different stats if you want to, say, farm currencies to buy better gear. So you need a farm character, and then you need a tank character for bossing and stuff like that.
Yeah, totally. I get what you're saying. Yeah, because there's some characters that are better for farming and stuff if you have to kill a lot of shit versus like a tank type. Yeah, it's interesting when people start playing with multiple classes and learn all of them. And it's a weird problem too, because like eventually on the elite levels or the elite gaming type of concept, you have to play multiple characters, right? Because you won't know enough about the other ones.
Yeah.
In order to cooperate with them in sort of like a cohesive way, because you don't even know what the capabilities of the other ones are, at least not on a deep level. And yeah. that's what makes it just, that's also, it creates that barrier to entry problem.
I think that's like relating that back to DeFi. I think it's important for you to just burn a certain amount of money when you first start, like $500 or $1,000 or something, and just play with different protocols and just think of that money as gone. Just go figure out how to interact with things like anchor borrowing, like get liquidated, go farm some degen tokens to learn.
But the funny thing is, it's actually hard for people who are responsible with their money, like, to actually literally play with their money, right? Because it feels like a weird sort of like gambling. It psychologically feels like, hey, you know what? I'm like, why am I doing this? Why am I, you know, you're quitting.
Throwing away money.
Yeah, it just feels like you're throwing away money. It's like, that's why it's almost like the roadmap has to be built for people. Like, okay, the first thing you might want to do is this. And the second thing you might want to do is this because X, Y, and Z, right? Like, and then you say, okay, well, what do you want to accomplish? Do you want to have, like, you know, leverage access to specific, you know, gains? Or do you want to have, like, take your yield, which is super low risk, and then use that for interesting things? Like, what are you trying to accomplish? And you, without that roadmap for people, like the cheat guide, so to speak, the problem is that people just don't know where to go in DeFi. And like you said before, it's like in MMOs, like if you didn't play all the different classes, you don't understand how these things work in permutations. And yeah, it's a very interesting problem that if you don't play, you don't learn. On the other hand, like the larger an ecosystem gets, the harder it is to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Very yeah,
and ultimately, the more you need to play, the bigger it gets.
Yeah, I think like the beginner guide ultimately is like, what are the actual base things that 95% of people probably would want to get out of DeFi, and then like just focus on those things that make most people successful most of the time, and then everything else is just monkeying around at that point, right? It's like, I don't know how that like endpoint gets achieved exactly.
I think that's even difficult, like pointing someone to the right direction in DeFi, because when you tell like someone who's completely new and doesn't even really have experience with traditional finance, everything is just completely unknown to them. They don't even know what they can do with debt or leverage. They don't even know what those things are. So you ask them like what their goals are and what their risk profile is. They don't even know how to answer. They just want to make money.
So although I do think it's easier to get into an understanding of leverage in crypto faster than traditional finance, only because the access is so much
it's more immediate.
Open.
It's immediate.
It's immediate. It's more open, and you don't have to go through pages and pages of waivers and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
Not only that, but there's like, you know, even just to open up a margin account somewhere, there's like a bunch of regulatory crap you have to sign. It freaks people out. So those kind of things, I think, in DeFi are more accessible, certainly, but also obviously it's possible for people to get, you know, pretty heavily wrecked because
they have no idea what they're doing, and then they throw their life savings into this 100x leverage margin call and get liquidated.
Yeah, because I think what it is like the nerds who are going to be successful anyway in gaming, in DeFi, like these are the nerds that are going to be successful either way, right? Like they're going to do, they have the inclination and the knack for this sort of thing. It'd be the same thing if like I go start doing art, right? I have a modicum of understanding of it. But it's not like I'm going to create masterpieces anytime soon. And therefore, if I go, the only difference is you're not going to like lose money on leverage in, you know, by, you know, creating a painting. Right. So you're the worst you lose is like the time it took for you to create your shitty painting. And now you just wasted your time. But you're not really like, you know, wrecking your life as a result of doing a piece of artwork. You a creator. Right. But the difference in like finances is that, you know, presumably other people around you are affected and all this other stuff. So yeah, the training component is tough. And, you know, like leverage and this and that isn't for everybody, obviously. So that's another problem. There is a psychological component too, whereas not everyone can handle the mental anguish of it. right? Like seeing number go up is fun, but seeing number go down is really, really yeah. not fun.
yeah.
So, well, and then add to that, like the litany of like it in, I guess it's, it, there is a parallel to gaming in the sense that like a really shitty video game, you're out like, let's say $50, right? You're like, shit, this game is stupid. I don't know why I spent $50 on this, right? Because it's funny because like you can get a really, really, really great game for $50. But at the same, in the same store, you can get a really, really shitty game for $50, right? And yeah. how many games are on your rack that you're like, hey, you know what? Like, I have no idea why I bought that.
You play it like once or not even at all. I have so many Steam games that I've just bought and haven't even played.
It just sits right there because you thought it'd be good and you haven't even bothered.
Yeah.
But the difference is you haven't really lost anything. But when, you know, when you spend a whole lot of time in something and, you know, in theory, you've lost some time, I suppose. That's kind of like your opportunity cost. And, you know, with games, like the difference is you don't really think too much of it. But that's the other thing with like metaverse style games is the more time you spend on something and the more actual financial like incentive you create in that game. The problem is the loss gets magnified substantially too. So it's like what T was talking earlier that he lost like $15,000 in some video game situation because he got wrecked. You know, it's become sort of like a gambling situation, but it's also kind of like the anguish of the loss gets statistically much larger, and you know, it tends to get people. You know, in gaming where there is no financial incentive, it can remain fun because you just dust yourself off and move on. But it's a much bigger problem when you've lost a lot of money, possibly, and then you have to dust yourself and move on, right? It's the same thing as like making a bad call in crypto and like you buy the top and it goes to the bottom. And you're like, oh,
yeah, it's like crypto is just trial by fire. I feel like everybody is christened by that one play that they make or two. But that one play that they see 15, 30x and then they just watch it go to zero because they didn't know how to get out.
Do you tend to bother with things like stop losses or no?
Yeah. Well, I've changed my I wouldn't say portfolio. I've changed my strategy for crypto over the past few months. I mainly only did like degen plays at the beginning, like the really crazy stuff on Phantom that I was talking about earlier. That's kind of how I got into it.
You mean like things with like wild APYs or what do you mean?
Yeah. So mainly the Tomb Forks. I would play the Tomb Forks a lot. So on launch, they would have Genesis pools that would earn like 10% daily APY and APRs. And the idea was to pay attention to them, claim your rewards, and sell whenever the price begins to tank, because most of these coins are supposed to be pegged to the coin that you're pairing with. And oftentimes they're 10 to 15x the price of that in the Genesis pool, which is why the APR is so crazy. But obviously that coin is going to tend to whatever the price that it's pegged to. So it's going to, that means it's going to go down by 15x. So there's a lot of money to be, there's a lot of money to be made there. But when I first started doing that, I didn't understand that. I learned that the hard way, just like aping into these things, because I saw these crazy APYs of 5 to 10 to 30% daily returns. And some of them were really good. Like there was one main fork called Tuomb, T-O-M-B, and or I mean sorry not T-O-M-B, the number two followed by O-M-B, and Harry Ye actually partnered with T-O-M-B, or I can't say it, whatever, Tomb. They partnered with this Tomb fork, and the price ended up shooting like 15x from my initial purchase, and this was like my first burn. So I 15x'd to like 50k, like turned 2k to 50k. And then now the issue comes in where you're a part of a community, you support the coin, And you believe in the project because now there's a billionaire backing it. And then now you're just exit liquidity for all of the people that entered it way at the beginning. And even people on Harry A's side in the original Tomb protocol just came over and dumped liquidity on everybody. So my investment from 50K went all the way down, back down to 2K to like $500 or something. I took... that's my Phantom. That was my first Phantom experience. So after that, I got smart and I just played. I played those moves because I knew they were coming in pretty much all of them, and I would kind of just scalp them.
Wait, but was that your first foray into like DeFi, or was that just something you got into?
My first real experience was Anchor. I got into Anchor first because I was just looking for stablecoin yields, and like I got into BlockFi earning 9%, whatever.
Got it. So you're like me. You just got in for the initial yield. And then
yeah,
not figured
I'm
it out
like there. Obsessed with interest. I'm one of those people that's just obsessed with earning interest. So I got into BlockFi, and then I found like Celsius, which earned like 12 or 13%. And then I don't know. I found something else that gave 15, and then I found Anchor that gave 20, and it just kind of spiraled from there. Because then I found the other like DeFi crazy APYs.
That's why I went and threw some cash in a couple of days ago in Spectrum, because the coin price looks sane, and then the yields right now are like, at least on current price of the coin, it's like around 30%. In governance. So I was like, all right, I'm just gonna throw some in here, because it already went through like you know, it bottomed out in terms of like price discovery. They've got like version 2 of their like tokenomics program and everything to increase like value to the coin. So if I'm getting in now, like even if the coin goes up and the APY falls relative, it's paid in UST, so it doesn't like it doesn't affect the output of the yield is tied more to the current price than the future price. So that's kind of a good thing, because it's not an inflationary yield, right? So it's sustainable. So it matters to get in relatively low as opposed to getting in relatively high.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to worry about you don't have to worry about the price of the coin at that point, because you get in low enough to where it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then your yield just sort of has to be sustainable long run. So yeah, the gamification of like figuring out like what's the right price to get things, and like when they change these tokenomics and whatnot, should I go and like get involved? That kind of thing is all very interesting.
Yeah, I'm like super skeptical of farm tokens now because of Phantom. The hyperinflation is insane, and ultimately like 98% of farm tokens are going to tend to zero. It doesn't really matter what utility you add, except for some new ones now.
Or at least tend to zero compared to the price you bought it at, right?
Yeah.
Because the odds are that like you get into something after you hear about it, it oftentimes is not the instant it's released. And even if it's the instant it's released, the problem is that depending on how much token unlocks there are, right?
Yep. Yeah.
So it's like you can't win for winning at that point.
Yeah, it's amazing. The first time I noticed like the tokenomics of farm tokens, I just pulled up a graph of a farm token, and then I pulled up a graph of the US dollar, and they tracked almost identically. And it's the same inflationary graph that you see in pretty much every farm token.
What do you think about, for example, have you looked into the like Astroport very closely, because it's basically a DEX token, right?
Yeah, I know about it a little bit. I don't know too much about the protocol though.
I felt like because I acquired the token through farming in the first place, and it didn't really require, like you're provided an opportunity to get it without any serious like risk.
Yep.
And then you sort of park it, and theoretically it earns for you after that. I think that makes sense, right?
But yeah, it depends how it's earning, because if you're just auto compounding Astro back in, and it doesn't really have any other utility. All they're doing is locking your gains into their coin. But if like smart money is just going to take that return, they take that coin and dump it. No, nobody wants to hold that because there's no other utility to it. But I, like I said, I don't know like what else Astro is doing.
Astro at least has like a governance deal where you can redirect more yield towards your farms if the more you have. So it's like the convex curve war situation. Okay. So there is a precedent for it to where it has a value model where it's highly probable that other protocols on Terra would want to own the Astro token.
Okay.
For all these various like yield earning options, you know, yeah, the curve convex situation I think is the best like corollary to what this is, and this is going to be like Astro and retrograde.
Yeah, they're going to basically Astro Wars situation.
Yeah, it's basically an Astro War, and at least if there's some gamified reason for this, it makes sense. But here's the thing: like if you look at like, I think it was Curve like token, you know, after like DeFi summer last year, the Curve token got just wrecked afterwards. So like no matter how
destroyed,
no matter how much you gamify something, like when the sell pressure comes in, man, like if someone's really hot far ahead, like they've already pulled a 10x on their shit, right? On the way down, well, I mean, there comes a point after which if you go up too fast, too hard, like you're going to have sellers pretty much for sure.
Yeah.
And that psychological impact cannot be like separated from the rest of the story, because it's the same thing. Like look at Luna, for example, right? Like the tokenomics are impressive, right? You got really, really good reasons for value accrual, you have a deflationary mechanism, blah blah blah, right? But if you said, you know, okay, it's $100 now, if you said, all right, what would happen if over the course of the coming year it reached $1,000, like a Bitcoin or something like that did, there's a psychological impact to that 10x that cannot be separated from the rest of the tokenomics and whatnot, right? Like I mean, you can separate it, meaning like you can try to analyze it, differently. But at the end of the day, a human being, they don't really care how the price 10x, right? Oh, they're going to have a tendency to dump it regardless of the tokenomic details.
Yep.
Like,
yeah. And the people that are dumping are always going to have more liquidity because of it's smart money. Like they're going to be dumping on the retail investors who aped in, bought the farm coin instead of farming it and made liquidity pairs or something along those lines.
Well, so this is probably especially true because the people with the largest wallets can move the price downward. And if they're the first ones to do it, then they have already exited by the time you figure, hey, look, the market's on a downtrend. Because for most people, that's going to look like just like, oh, look, it's just a 10% dip or a 20% dip, right? But the presumption is that those same people that sold at that price are going to buy back lower, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And that's what causes that kind of like those trend drops. But yeah, the market psychology is like there's a certain amount of increase in value where a certain fraction of people are going to have a tendency to sell. And that's not to say that like you can predict exactly when these things are going to happen. It's just that the higher number goes, the more likely they're going to be sellers. That's like why BTC, like in the early days, you know, the first like peak was the 350-day moving average multiplied by 21. The second peak was the 350-day moving average multiplied by 13. It's like these fib levels of 350-day moving averages, and it like conformed to that for year after year after year. So it's interesting, like especially because a low liquidity, a low market cap, low liquidity situation, you can move the price so much higher, so much quicker, and then the second time it becomes harder. And the third time, it becomes even harder and harder to get like that massive move without some sort of mega catalyst, right? Like imagine BTC right now, like to go from a, you know, let's say $1 trillion market cap, you try to get it to go to a like $10 trillion market cap.
Like, yeah, it gets exponentially more difficult to get that.
It does. It does. And like the catalyst has to be amazing too. Like some massive, you know, like sovereign
currency is now Bitcoin.
Yeah. Some sovereign decides to come in and they figure, you know what, like we're big enough. We can move the price of BTC from 1 trillion to 10 trillion. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, the US government or something. And they decide, you know what, like we would hold enough of it that, and we have enough money that if anyone else tries to dump it below, we can buy it anyway. So in other words, for the 10 trillion that you spent, you have like 100 trillion in reserve to buy more.
Yep.
So you essentially set the floor price at that point. And that's the kind of situation where, you know, those kinds of moves can really happen. So in other words, to make a $10 trillion move, you know, a serious investor or a sovereign would want to have way more than that, right? Because you got to have enough to buy the dip. Because your whole point is to pump your own bag at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah, you essentially have to create a scenario where you get it to be high enough and stay there. And eventually enough new people come in and buy, like, let's say $1 million Bitcoin. Then you have like the possibility of like properly fungible exit liquidity to actually move money in and out of there. Right. It's fascinating how it works.
Yeah, that's part of the like downside of some of these coins is they rely on new money coming in, and as soon as the TVL is dried up and there's no new money coming in, they just fall, they just drop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the all these protocols are having an interesting time building in some sort of system to maintain sustainability, but you'll notice like if you look at like Kujira, you look at some like Apollo DAO, you have this idea that each protocol is becoming kind of its own little mini hedge fund,
mm-hmm.
such that like you almost have to have a revenue stream separate from whatever the heck it is you're offering as a as a actual service.
Yeah, exactly. So are you familiar with Time Wonderland at all?
A little bit, yeah. I understand the concept behind it to some extent, but I don't know the entire like sequence of events.
Yeah, so the whole thing was a bit of a shit show. But what ultimately ended up happening is they transitioned into almost becoming the first decentralized venture capitalist, and they were using new people's money to deposit into a treasury for, well, now we know Sifu, to reinvest into farming opportunities or different up and coming projects. And basically he was just investing everybody else's money for them. And what the protocol was doing was then everybody would vote on acquisitions, and the treasury would then purchase other projects. I think they only purchased one at the time. I don't know what's going on with it anymore, but they purchased a crypto betting platform known as BetSwap, and they purchased, I think it was like $18.5 million around a half a cent, and then another $10 million or something at 1 cent. And at launch, they had 10x'd the investment because the coin was worth about 12 cents.
Did they dump at that point, or what did they do?
It was airdropped to the holders there were two coins. It was Time and then Memo. Memo is just the staked version of Time. So if you were a holder of Memo, you got an allocation to the coins that they bought. I don't think the execution on it was very good, but I thought it was a pretty crazy idea that we can have decentralized venture capitalists like that.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. Yeah, eventually that, I think, concept of decent, I think that can eventually become popular, the problem is it goes right back to who do you trust with this money?
Yeah.
And in DeFi, there's only so many rational applications in DeFi. So what are these things going to ultimately invest in? Right. This is the same problem I have with like DAOs and whatnot on chain. I'm like, okay, there's only like four or five very interesting protocols. Let's say there's like a dozen things that could really stand the test of time. Here you are now a DAO and you're like buying a little bit of what? Astroport, maybe some Prism token or whatever it is you're buying. And you know for sure. Like Luna has a certain yield and, you know, there is a rationality to that yield and when that yield is going to go down and some other predictable things, right? So in you know, it makes sense for each of those DAOs to have some Luna. Then they're like, okay, we're going to hold a little bit of Astro. We're going to hold a little bit of this and that. But ultimately, like, you'll notice the problem is you run out of possible investment opportunities. Yeah. No different than if you're an individual. And then as soon as you have to go off chain, who the hell knows what's happening with that money? That's a different set of problems. So these DAOs collecting money on one chain and claiming to make money somewhere else. And then you're going to bring that back to your user somehow. That's highly dubious. Tons of places where people can like skim money. Because when you're talking about, you know, tens of millions to hundreds of millions, billions in TVL, it is so easy to like come up with reasons to skim a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, so, like, yeah. So you know, that's going to happen. And then it's to the extent that like if a founder makes a good solid, you know, for a lot of people, if they're make a good solid 10 to 10 plus million, they're like, you know, I really don't want to do this thing anymore. Right. Like they just, exactly. They're not nearly as interested.
Yeah. And yeah, there's a lot of conspiracies regarding Sifu and the treasury, obviously because of his background. There was a felon managing $1.5 billion. And I think he ran away with something like 110 million or something. Not sure if it's confirmed to be from the Wonderland treasury. But even then, like, how did he get that money? Like, where was it scraped from?
Exactly. Once you start scraping from here and there, it's just not that difficult at that mm-hmm. point, right? Because if you're really good in DeFi, you certainly can come up with good ways to scrape money from different things, okay. Right?
And he was like, he may have been a felon, but that guy knew his shit.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the funny thing the interesting thing about those people is they could actually make so much money just doing it straight up. Right?
Yeah, like, so much.
It makes no sense for them to like get rid of all of this trust capital they've developed when it's so easy to make money off these protocols and things. And like, why kill the cash cow? The other thing is too, like, then on top of that, you have a bunch of people that are pissed off at you that might be willing to kill you. So, so like creating enemies for yourself among who knows who. You know, some drug cartel lord, you know, lost their shit because they, you know, got time in Wonderland or something. And now they come after you. That would probably not be fun.
No. Yeah, so. No, I mean, it's like, I feel like that's the one part of crypto that people kind of forget is the quote, bad actors. Like going all the way back to the beginning, Silk Road, the people that first started using not DeFi, but just crypto in general and learning the ropes of blockchain and interacting with contracts were criminals. And there's a lot of criminals out there that are making names for themselves in the crypto space and we don't even know about them.
Yeah. What's the name of that kid? He's still in prison. The Silk Road founder. I forget his name.
What's his name? Shit.
Anyway,
Ross,
yeah. Ross Ulbricht or whatever his name is. Yeah. So yeah, Lucky, what's up, man? You're just like hanging out.
Yeah, he's been hanging out here for a while.
We just
Well, I had no take in the game space because I rarely played games in my life.
Oh my God, what's wrong with you?
I was cutting grass, Effie, and trying to earn money. When I was like 16 years old.
Jesus.
I was making money in games at like 13.
Mowing lawns.
My dad gave me a lawnmower at 16. My brother, he was 3 years younger than me. And he's like, here's a lawnmower. He's like, you got to cut our grass and then go figure out what you got to do. So by the time I was 21, I had 100 lawns I was cutting.
My God. Look at you.
So I was making like $5,000 cash as like a 16-year-old every week. It was crazy.
My God.
100 lawns?
Yeah, we literally had a whole landscape business.
Did you have like, is that like a motorized lawnmower? Did you upgrade?
We had a Skag. We had a Skag 52-inch and then a Push 36-inch, two trimmers, two blowers. I had people on Saturday coming and helping me out. I'd pay them cash. It was crazy. I had a whole business.
I swear.
Dude, insane. You know the entire lingo of the lawn mowing business.
Skag.
I didn't understand a word you just said, I think.
Oh, yeah. I can hook you up. What was I going to tell you? Why did I come up here? Oh, I know why. Because when you guys were talking about the profit and loss, I'm like, I'm kind of happy that I don't ever see my P&L in Terra anywhere. You know why? Because there's a mental thing around this. Like, I can tell you that I've probably been down in sometimes, but I don't even think about it anymore. I just kind of go to the mindset of like, accumulate, don't get liquidated, accumulate, don't get liquidated, make sure I have cash, don't get liquidated, and then just hold. Like, it's just, it's kind of a mental, it's kind of cool mentally. It's changed my mind a little bit on it.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, because you know when you're accumulating because your number of Luna goes up, but when you're losing value, number doesn't go down. So it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, looking at the P&L, essentially, it's like in the game concept, it's like you're no longer immersed in the game. You're thinking too much about like what you might use that money for in the real world, whereas if you ignore that it actually exists in like any kind of real context, like you just know how much, you know, okay, I've got some Luna and I got more of it because I did this and this, but I don't even know what it's worth anymore. That actually makes it possible to like continue your trend of activities and just keep doing that well, right? Like you don't even think about it as money. It makes more sense. It's the same thing in the gaming concept. It's like the moment you equated like your fancy shit that you got in the game or whatever with how much you're going to sell it for, that just changed the game at that time. I remember that like specifically. Yeah. It ruined gaming for me, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So when we were talking about this earlier, like NFTs and stuff, I wanted to bring this up. So I was in first-person shooters a lot. Like I started in COD and stuff. But when I moved to PC and started playing Counter-Strike, the whole skin trading scene was huge. You could just go on to Steam, click on people's profiles and message them directly, and you could trade for these skins, and nobody was doing it. So as soon as I saw that I could trade, it's kind of like the paperclip trading to a house story. I just had like a $5 skin with something that was kind of rare on it that I could upsell just by talking to people. So I ended up trading a $5 skin up to like $2,000 or $3,000 worth of other skins, like over a course of 6 months. But like people value these things. And that's kind of where I see like NFTs and games going. Is just skins, because if you add liquidity to in-game skins, there is an entire ecosystem for that, and it's been around for like, I played CSGO for 5 years or 6 years or something like that now, and I did that when I was super young. Like it's been around, it's a thing. And even in Fortnite, people will sell their accounts for skins. Specifically, people will spend $10,000-$20,000 on accounts. It's insane.
Why do you think it is that like Steam doesn't want to get into blockchain transactions at this point, right? Like they wanted to avoid that.
Yeah. So I don't know if they are avoiding blockchain skins or just blockchain games. I think they spoke about not wanting blockchain games.
I don't know about I think what they mean by blockchain games is like some sort of transactional layer ending in crypto where like liquidity is coming in and out from the crypto space into Steam. I'm not sure why they wouldn't want that. It almost seems like they would want that because that would bring all sorts of like cash into video games.
Valve has a history of making poor business decisions regarding new technologies.
really, that's a Steam thing?
That is just like, that's just a Steam thing. But
do you believe it's because of their philosophy on what they think like games should be like, or do you think that's just like they're not thinking of it from a business angle?
So going back to the CSGO skins, I don't think they think about it from a business angle because everything was third party. So in order to liquidate the skins, I had to go to a separate website to sell them for real money. You can only sell them on the marketplace for Steam cash. And when I was trading it back then, you can't even come close to doing that now because they put so many restrictions on it and just try to shut it down as much as possible. It takes 7 days to close a trade between accounts. It takes 7 days to close a sale on the marketplace. You have to go through like two-factor authentication, like for every transaction. And you have to verify your account, I think, every 30 days, which takes another 7 days before you can even trade anything. They made it so hard for this ecosystem to even exist, but yet it still does. Where if they just turned the narrative around and accepted it, they could make so much money just by accepting transaction fees.
But here's another thing. Do you think the allure of the skins and their value would be the same if you didn't have to go through all these hoops?
No, I don't think so.
You know what I'm saying? Like, doesn't that scarcity or that,
I see what you're saying. Yeah. But
it's like, hey, I'm elite because I went and did this through this like nefarious like set of whatever.
No, I see what you're saying, but that's not how they work, because the way that you get the skins in the first place is by spending $2.50 on a key and then opening a box that drops when you play the game. And it's a rarity based system. So the more valuable the skin, obviously, the more it's worth. But it's like a lottery system. So you open the box with this key. It costs you $2.50 roughly. And then you have the chance to open this item. So the rarity is where most of the value comes from, because there's different conditions of the skins. So there's like battle scarred, field tested, minimal wear, factory new. And some have specific, it's called a float value. It's just a decimal number that's assigned to this skin, and there's a scale for each quality. So for factory new, the flow value could be 0.92 to 1, and then minimal wears, whatever. But if you have a 0.92 factory new skin versus a 0.98 factory new skin, the 0.98 is going to be worth more than the 0.92.
But so is this purely a function of rarity, or is there like a utility difference for these things?
There is no utility for any of this. This is just pure rarity.
Okay, so it was just kind of like fun collecting these, and yeah, it became like an NFT type of situation.
Yeah, it's NFTs without being labeled NFTs.
And now, how much money would these things go for?
Oh, crazy numbers. So some knives, I think the most expensive knife that I saw when I was playing like a while ago was around $12,000. And some people have portfolios of these skins worth $250,000.
People are crazy.
Yeah, people will spend life lucky on this
it's
stuff.
Because you don't get money like mowing lawns. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, this is what I'm people saying. Are crazy. Lawns, I was doing this. It's a crazy market.
Can I bitch? I got to bitch about something real quick.
Go so, for it.
I've been using Anchor and moving money around and DEXs and things, and it's been super easy, right? Like, I mean, it's split seconds. I go to the bank to deposit my goddamn line of credit check. So I wrote a check for like, I don't know, it was like $230,000 or whatever it was. It's on hold. I'm like you guys calling the validator over here to make sure the block's going to get written. Like, what the? I like literally was on hold for an hour today with Chase. like, can you tell me why this is on hold? Well, we have to call this other bank, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, is this a joke?
Like, why? Why do you have
As to I'm like- seeing Twitter feeds of like $2 million move, and it's probably moving within like 10 seconds. Like, it's ridiculous.
You know, I feel the same thing. Every time I go to interact with the bank, it's just so painful. I tried to wire transfer. It was like 15K to Coinbase Pro. And I had to call my bank three times to verify the information of the wire transfer. Like, there's no reason for that.
Yeah, it's like this. Like, we have but like a generation to go where enough people have been gaming long enough, and they have gotten used to sort of like digital asset spaces that, like, you know. The number of people who are going to, well, first off, like, a lot of people have not, like my kids, I'm pretty sure, have never written like a letter with a stamp on it
in cursive.
Cursive, yeah, right. And I'm pretty sure, like, they haven't, like, my older one's like hitting, he's 19. I'm pretty sure he has not written a check before, right? Like, he has sort of an account, but he hasn't really written a check. There's going to be, you know, generation by generation. Like, first it was like credit cards, using them online, which is a funny thing in the first place. But then, you know, just as things go along, like, the experience of like interacting with money in the way people have done it in the past is, like, at least on a consumer banking level, I think the consumer banking industry literally goes to zero. Like, and I've told people that like are studying or like planning on going to careers in that field to just don't.
Yeah,
it makes zero sense. It's like they're the Blockbuster Video of the coming generation. Yeah, no question about it. No, but that's not to say that, like, you know, 99% of DeFi protocols aren't bullshit, right? Like, there's a lot of garbage out there too.
Yeah, but like what Amazon has done for my shopping experience, like Anchor has done for my banking experience, right? Like, I think about these things that have changed the way that I expect certain things, right? Like, if it's not a day now that I get something, I'm like frustrated. Like, I'm like, why does it take so long?
Yeah. We're just like, we need to be like instantly satisfied with whatever we're doing at this point, because like technology is here, but the people that are running things, or the things that are actually implemented in everyday life, is it's not cooperating with technology.
You know what I noticed? Like, so you go to the like wholesale stores, and you know how, like, so a 4K TV now, like, you can buy a 55-inch, pretty decent 4K TV, right? Like, you know, $300, like, it's like, is anyone actually watching TV? Like, given the fact that, like, they can't sell a TV for more than whatever that, you know. And then the, like, you get into like 8K level and stuff, you're still sitting at like, maybe you could probably get one for like 3,000-4,000, something like that, which is really quite reasonable. Like in
well, compared to a couple of years ago, yeah. It's,
well, in the year 2000, if you were ordering up a decent plasma TV back then, like a really good one would cost you over $50,000. Like, I don't think people realize, like, that younger people that are younger, like, that weren't, like, you know, in the market for a TV back then, just can't even imagine like what you can buy with your money now. It's actually quite shocking. It's all this tech deflation. Let's keep saying it. Like, it's the only reason why the public hasn't revolted with the amount of inflation going on.
Have you heard of the book, The Price of Tomorrow?
I have. I haven't read it though. What's going on there?
Exactly that. It talks about the natural deflation with technology, and how prices are just getting cheaper, but the currency is getting the currency is just going to zero, and things are becoming more expensive because of it.
Yeah, that's why my thesis ultimately is that actually the final currency is actually tech itself.
Yeah,
and I don't think it's I don't think personally that Bitcoin is it, by the way. I know it's heresy to say such things. But the, what it's going to be, I think, ultimately is the power of like the power of thought itself. So machine language gets more and more complex. The number one sort of like use case for computation becomes neural networks, because like if you look at like how life works, it uses a, like the number one energy consuming organ in our body is the human brain. And the reason for that is because like that makes you like it makes human beings immensely more powerful than a monkey, for example. So it's worth that energy expenditure. And ultimately, like the power of thought is ultimately the last currency of, well, the universe. Like that's it. So, you know, now that we're sort of going into like computational space, then the number one reason that you would spend money on anything is for that neural network capability. So either you are going to like the machine learning doctor, you're going to the machine learning, I don't know, like whatever service you're talking about, whatever like metaverse experience you think you're going to have, whatever it is, ultimately, all the services can ultimately be sort of like boiled down to you paying in some sort of like ML based currency. And so simultaneously, so in other words, if you think about the proof of work of Bitcoin, the difference would be it'd just be proof of thought. And it wouldn't be human beings that you're proving, like proof of, like if you have human beings playing a video game, and they're like, for example, like you're mining for gold in EverQuest or whatever, that's sort of like more of a proof of, it's a proof of thought on a certain level. Like a CAPTCHA is a proof of thought, right? Like to prove that a bot is not like in there doing it. But the difference is that the proof of thought in a video game situation doesn't actually provide a whole lot of anyone else with any kind of real service. So it really is just more of you just doing proof of work. You're no different than the Bitcoin, you're not any different than a cycle of computation. But the difference would be that if that computational work actually performed a function in a neural network, then all of a sudden, you're just not like, people aren't going to say, well, you're just wasting the energy, or you are wasting the silicon, or like it's, you're just making heat, but it doesn't actually do anything. What will eventually happen is that like thought itself will be the ultimate currency of the planet. And that will be done through these computational networks. And that's it. There is no further higher, right. There's no higher currency than that at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. And this book actually kind of talks about it more, not necessarily the currency of thought, but data being a currency. But I mean, data is ultimately the result of thinking.
A mix of those two things. Like it's, there's data, but there's also kind of there's like the higher order functions of data, right? Like there's a difference between like sentience and just having reams and reams of hard drives of data.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the and just look at like what in game, like for example, Mu Zero and Alpha Zero and everything, like in the use of machine learning for in the gaming space, as sort of like the early experiments, super, super efficient, by the way. Like it's amazing how relatively easy it was to develop systems that powerful. And we're just like at the literal tip of the iceberg for that. And ultimately, you won't even know that you're interacting with these things. In fact, I think even other machines won't realize they're interacting with other machines. That's what's about to go down, right? Which is going to be a real world.
Like rule for that? What's that called? It's a test.
The Turing test?
Turing test, yeah.
But that's where you don't realize like a machine is not human. What I'm saying is machines won't realize that they're dealing with other machines.
Yeah.
So it's going to become so it's weird because if you have one sentient AI, let's say, in the universe of AIs, you have one thing going on, right? But if you have dozens of them all competing with each other for various resources, which that's probably would happen if you had simultaneous, because like as soon as you invent one, you have the immediate ability to replicate that one, right? Yeah. So like you can make seven copies of it or whatever, and they're all like doing whatever with each other, and you don't even know what their language they're speaking at that point. And they might get to the point where they don't know what each other's languages are, because there's not enough like computational time in the universe to actually figure out like the other ones. Like it's almost like how BTC, you know, it takes a certain amount of computations to, like create a Bitcoin, right? Same concept, like the amount of computational time it would take to decode what the other neural network is doing would actually be like potentially as large as all the processing power in the universe. So then what ends up happening is that each of these networks becomes like almost like a node in and of itself, and they're all communicating with each other. It just becomes very complicated. But somewhere in the middle, human beings have no idea what's going on. That's the problem. And that's like that universe we're about to sort of enter. But I think that's where, like, I think that's where the final currency is, in my opinion. It's like that's the end game of, of where that goes. Because I can't think of anything higher, really. Right? Like, it ain't going to be like gold or whatever. Like, no one's going to care about your gold. Like the Peter Schiff arguments, like sounds like an idiot, basically.
No, I completely see that. You should really read that book. It talks a lot about that. It also focuses on how like jobs are going. Every single job is going to be completely phased out by technology, and we're only at the tip of the iceberg regarding that technology. And just like following Moore's law with everything, it's just going to get exponentially faster and faster and faster with how fast these jobs are getting.
No, it's for sure. Down. Like even with existing basic like algorithmic programming techniques, you'll find that like whatever profession you're in, you could on a napkin figure out how to do that profession better if a computer were to handle just a few of the tasks in a rational manner, and if the data were packaged in such a way to have that data, like, you know, be processed for you, right? And like, it doesn't matter which professional you are, like anybody in this room, like who's doing whatever job, you can figure out like on a napkin pretty much what could make this happen. And the only thing preventing it is really just a function of implementation predominantly. It's not a function of like that it's impossible, right? In fact, it's
actually a function of gathering that data to make it happen. Like that's what's stopping
it. It's pretty much a certainty, right? Like if you think about it, it's just a matter of when, not if. Like we talked about this, Lucky, with payments and such. It's like you can tell exactly how the world to be changed in terms of payments. It's just the adoption is the hard part. You know, the bootstrapping of adoption is a hard part, and then the development piece of the puzzle is doable. But the reason why development doesn't happen that easily is because the developer doesn't know if there's sufficient like market for it, right? Or not market, but they don't know that their version of this universe is going to be adopted. So they tend not to sort of push that boundary. They'd rather have the bird in the hand than the, than two in the bush or whatever. And I think that's why like people tend to stick with existing networks. Like we talked about this, like with Visa and MasterCard, for example, you know, like there's a reason why most vendors now want to take standard payment rails and standard credit cards and such, because there's like an ecosystem built around that and they don't have to spend a lot of capital on their end. And they know their customers all have these cards, right? So what is the reason to like accept, I don't know, UST on Terra, for example, when all this other shit is already built up? And but so in other words, it's just
Okay, sorry, Steffi, but OKX just is accepting UST as a trading pair
for everything.
Dil Kwan just posted it.
But they're
so they the CEO of OKX just said, "Hey, lunatics, UST trading pairs will be available on OKX. Here we go."
Oh, so for all for everything then.
I don't know. That's huge.
No, it is huge. No, what you want to cut you off. In fact, what you want to see is you want to see the biggest bot trading platforms in the world switch, not just use UST, but switch to UST for all the bots, because that's where a lot of the volume is, and that would make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Because people don't exit bots just willy-nilly. They usually let them run. So that's almost like, imagine like taking UST and just locking it up for a long time.
Yeah.
Trading.
No, but back to the data piece, you know, it's funny because the role I sit in, you know, for a very large enterprise right now is it comes down to data and how people process data and what data can be sent and decisions made off of data. And it's like, you're right, on the back of the napkin, you can write how some of these large corporations, like even outside of the, just within the four walls of the organization, how they could operate more efficiently or effectively if data was handled better. The problem is that sometimes implementation is hard, or also just getting to the data is just too big of a burden in some cases. And people want to have manual interaction because they feel like they need to, but in reality, I guarantee you could automate 90% of what's being done.
Yeah, you could automate 90% of what most people is being done. It's just simply a function of implementation. The other thing too is, like, imagine things like laws. So if all laws were sort of set up in such a way that they were like, they were sort of programmable. So if there's like a financial law, for example, and you have to follow it, like, I don't know, sales tax or something like that, then that sort of module would just be plugged into, you know, whatever it is you're doing. And that would essentially carry out the function of like collecting sales tax and sending it straight to the state, for example, right? Like, there's no obvious reason that can't be instantaneous. Like, why we're filing sales taxes and then, you know, sending them in and all this other garbage. Like, it clearly could be automated with existing technology, without a doubt, right? Like, there's no technological limitation at all. And it's interesting how many things, how long they take, you know, from inception to actual creation. You're really talking about usually like a couple of generations almost, right? Like just think about how many things you can do on your smartphone today. But like, think about how rudimentary and how terrible, like, so many experiences are for so many professions. They're just not automated yet. But you know they will be, right? Like, it's just a matter of, I think some of the ways things are done will simply be replaced entirely. Like, it's actually harder to build, retrofit an existing world to like solve those problems versus completely starting from scratch with an entirely new platform that is more efficiently designed from the ground up to sort of do the task at hand. So I think you'll see, I think companies in various professions, whether it's accounting, medical, legal, it doesn't matter what it is. Like, I think you'll find that there'll be some dark horse kinds of projects that emerge out of the blue and you're like, what the hell? Like, it'll be like the Uber for taxi drivers, you know, it'll just show up and next thing you know, it's like, oh shit, my world's different now.
Yeah, I agree completely. Completely agree with that. It's interesting because technology moves so fast, but then corporations really can't adapt to it fast enough, especially like larger corporations. So there will be a point in time where there'll be an inflection point of like that dark horse that you're talking about. Because if they can't adapt and move fast enough, these other companies, that's why they end up taking market share quicker or are able to, you know, really have an advantage for what's happening in the world, because they're either starting fresh with no infrastructure or no kind of, you know, outdated things that they're trying to struggle through.
Yeah, it's partly because like a large scale infrastructure for anything creates like that psychology of previous investment problem, where like it'd be like the Blockbuster video problem. You built all these stores, you built them to like sell videotapes, and you know, your entire success depends on, like, I guess the customer rewinding their video and continuing to like rent videotapes, VHS tapes and whatnot. And then, you know, then of course, like, okay, digital comes along, and then now they do that with Blu-ray discs or, you know, DVD discs or whatever. And, but the inability to pivot is partly because it just basically means you have to plan for your own obsolescence. And instead of like closing down their physical locations in a much faster order, saying, hey, you know what, while we're ahead, let's like get out of this game. They have so much actual capital invested in that project. It's like they're not going to be able to pivot until it's too late, because their investors and their customers, for that matter, expect that thing to exist, so long as the actual, you know, customers and shareholders want that. And it's too, it just takes too long to pivot out of it, right? Like it's like if you have like a civilization built around like roads and highways, because, you know, oil was relatively cheap, and you know, the parts and stuff to build cars are relatively cheap. If that's no longer the case, then now you have a bunch of roads and shit that, like, and then buildings that are spread too far apart. You have everything like built wrong, and then now you're stuck with a bunch of infrastructure that is not easy to like retrofit into some new world paradigm. So yeah, the infrastructure problem is always the same story over and over again.
What do you see in the medical field that's kind of the next thing to get obsoleted? I mean, because, you know,
probably me, but
doctors,
yeah.
Like, from technology wise, like, what are you seeing?
Well,
what about like robotic surgeons and stuff, like the robotic arms?
Yeah, robotic surgery is interesting. It still requires the actual surgeon, but eventually, what happens with neural networks is you could actually train the robot, you know, with tons and tons of real surgeons, and then it can just basically replicate that. You know, cause like, what does a surgeon do? They just kind of learn, you know, they have a lifetime of hand eye coordination, and then they go and they learn maybe like 5 years of surgical training. Right. But if you have a robot that's learning the movements based on, like optics technology, and depth perception technologies, obviously, that are becoming more and more prominent, then you can just ultimately train like one neural network with the knowledge of, let's say, you know, like a million man hours of, you know, doctor time, right? Because what happens is the more of these robots you have, the more neural networks, like you connect all of them to the same network, and then the training effect becomes really, really powerful. So what you wind up with is like one neural network can be trained with like thousands of doctors worth of training time, right? And then it actually becomes cheaper to just simply connect your robot to that neural network than it does to like have a doctor train all their life to do this particular task. And remember, like, some of the tasks will start with like the easiest things, right? Like, hey, we just need to have this robot be able to take out, I don't know, sutures or something. Well, what'll happen is it has to be a task at first expensive enough that you don't want to have like, complicated enough that you don't want like a, you know, just a nurse to be able to handle, but you want it to be, simple enough to where you could get a robot to do it, right? And it'll be level after level where essentially you'll train it. So that's how that would eventually working. Neural networks will sort of take over those types of tasks, which seem like complicated on their surface, but maybe are really very, in many ways, standardized, right? Because like there's a standard of care of how you're supposed to take an appendix or, you know, close a wound or whatever. And even that's become like relatively more mechanized over time anyway. But I think even more so, like the information-based stuff is easy to make obsolete quickly, make human beings obsolete quickly. Take, for example, like let's say, what's a good example here? So let's say the diagnosis of like pneumonia, for example. You would have you have articles coming out, you know, every month regarding bacterial infections, and you have like, you know, studies being done, you have like different permutations and combinations of antibiotics and all these kinds of things, right? So all that data is going into various journals and things, but none of that's being translated necessarily into like either decision support trees automatically or some kind of algorithm or whatever. But at the same time, most docs aren't reading most of those things, right? A guidelines organization will, like NIH or somebody, they'll read all that shit. They'll put it all together into a position paper after dozens of people have, you know, reviewed it, made sure the studies are good. And then they'll stick it into some guideline. At least if those guidelines were to be put into like a decision tree where, like, let's say, a person walks into an ER, they get the data about, you know, what kind of symptoms they have, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, there is like a automated tree of things that you normally have to do, you know, when a person first shows up. Then like the data that starts coming in starts going, okay, well, we have this information, this, this, and this. Based on this study, we can then assign you to this antibiotic coverage, blah, blah, blah. And so, in other words, you automate a lot of this. And it starts with like what we call decision support, where at first it just like guides you, but later it just replaces you. Because at the end of the day, like of all that reams of data, realistically, like I could train a dozen people to do this. But at the end of the day, one robot or one neural network could replace all the doctors on the planet simultaneously. This is the problem, right? The scale with which a neural network can be accessed and replicate, like what it takes a lifetime to train a single person, it's just amazing. The other thing too is like you might think, well, okay, well, there's some decisions that might be a little bit more complicated. Sure. What will happen is at first, the easiest decisions, the ones that are easy to replicate over and over again and like are more like, I guess, cookbook, so to speak, like those things will come and take over first. And then what will happen is you'll see change move into the more and more and more complicated decisions. But it's like bringing that data in, bringing the research data in to inform the machine what has to be done. But I think also like you're going to eventually create neural networks that can just simply read the literature in plain text, analyze it like really, really well, and probably come up with guidelines on its own. Or another different way neural networks could be used is like, let's say the neural network is being fed tons and tons of lab values and tons of features. And all it's doing is just like watching the outcome of what you do as a doctor. Like it's watching, okay, if you give this antibiotic, what happens? That one, what happens? So the entire world becomes essentially an ongoing study of data. And the ML like network essentially is building its database. And eventually it doesn't even need to know why exactly one thing worked versus another thing worked. It'll just simply replicate it because it's effective, right? Right. It's statistically effective. And that's another interesting.
And if we have that data connected already, we'd probably solve a lot of things a lot quicker.
Yeah, no, there's no question. Like I know, like, you know, coming from a place of experience in my particular field, you know, like an ER physician, as an example, doesn't have the knowledge base in a particular specialty, right? So that's a person not equipped to catch all of the different problems that they don't even know they're missing. The unknown unknowns are fairly high in medicine, not even outside of your own field, much less like, you know, we were talking about this earlier when it comes to like learning DeFi or learning something. It like there's so many unknown unknowns that the ER doc doesn't know that a computational system would do a much better job with initial diagnostics than they would. Like I know this because they make mistakes over and over and over and over and over and over again all day long, right? Because they just don't know enough. Not so much mistakes in the sense that like they're life-threatening, but inefficient in that like, had you replicated me and stick me a bunch of ERs and I was, you know, that clone was available to handle all like lung problems that showed up, obviously that would be more efficient than having someone that's a jack of all trades trying to figure that out. Right. So that's what I'm saying. Like the inefficiencies, lots of them could be solved and you can easily lay out a napkin, like how to, where these like problems are. And you can identify where tech could solve them. It's just, the creation and implementation is really all that is lacking. Pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, I could talk about this stuff all day long. Especially implementation of just data and collecting data and like the power of data is just unbelievable. What people don't realize, wherever you work or whatever we do, it's really just data being passed back and forth. The more effective and efficiently that can happen, the more that is done, you know, properly, and there's a good foundation behind it, is really what enables a lot of things a lot quicker and faster.
Yeah. And some of it's just the stupidest information too. Like it's not even like high tech. Like for example, if I had a specific like drug reaction to something. Like, you know, I had a reaction to penicillin, I got a rash, and like, you know, I don't really want to take that again because it's a known problem for me, right? That's an example of something that, like, you walk into any hospital in the world, you should be able to say, hey, by the way, this is my, like, you know, blockchain based, you know, allergy recorder, whatever the hell, and you swipe it, and anywhere in the world they can access in some decentralized way without having to have access to a specific proprietary service or server. They could get that from anywhere in the world. You give them a token that gives them that information. They can basically, it's like almost like a wallet address. You know how you look, you know, you go on 8board and you stick your wallet address in there and it shows you a bunch of shit. Similar to that, but it gives them your, you know, you give them access. And then it would basically give you the key piece of information that they would need to know. But like, if I go to one hospital with one system and you own another hospital, another system, they may not even have the same stuff. And a lot of times people don't remember all this shit, not even about their own medical problems. I got news for you. Like most people don't remember a whole lot of anything, actually. They don't even know what pills they're taking, quite frankly. Like that's just normal. Like, hey, what are you taking? I don't know. I just have this bunch of bottles. Look in that bag. I'm like, what? You can't even list what you're on. So that's common. Most people, like,
or when people explain what they eat or drink, and they're like, yeah, I drink like, you know, or I eat like, you know, not that bad,
but like, or whatever.
yeah. Okay.
It's just pure. Well, it lacks any specificity for what you're trying to.
My wife works at the VA, so she has so many stories.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's So what it is the information that we oftentimes need and what actually benefits people, it's not that hard to aggregate it, really. It's just interesting that nobody is incentivized to solve this problem. The proprietary companies don't want to have this possibility because they make money off of the software, right? So there's not really a high tendency towards making this like open source, because if you made it open source, well, who's going to pay for the development? So it's one of those things. But anyway, it's a cyclical problem of funding versus implementation versus who stands to benefit and all that kind of thing. You have to have like a cohesive mechanism to pay for it all. And that's why crypto makes sense, right? Like, let's say you wanted to give your tokenization of your information to a hospital for some reason. Well, you just pay the transaction fee and that's the end of it, right? Like, you know, 4 cents on the tariff, work and boom, you now have like given this, you know, it'd be no different than getting your amps on Prism. Like, push a button, get a transaction fee, boom, you're done, right?
The problem is the people that want to hold that data that you just talked about, they want you to hold a token, which then costs money because there's incentivization. To your point, it's like, if there's no incentivization or money behind it, then are you getting the people to develop it? Like, it's just a circle of like, which way do you go with this?
Right. Yeah.
But you could argue that's how some open source applications are, right? I mean, if you think about open source, I mean, it's done by the community for the community. It just needs to grow big enough that there's a big enough benefit.
It's not that different than like you showing your like NFTs on your Terra Station wallet, for example, right? It'd be no different than that. Like your like particular document of list of shit that you need to share with somebody is sort of like showing up there, kind of like an NFT in a way, right? Like you're not planning on, it's basically a non-fungible piece of information.
Well, I'm more probably talking about the technology behind it. So like, you know, in our role, when we pick open source software for our enterprise, we have to be careful because of vulnerabilities, right? For a hospital to pick an open source type of application that's built by the community, I mean, it has to be pretty solid in a long way for this to get implemented into like hospital.
At any serious level, right?
Yeah.
It would have to be.
I mean, especially with the privacy data. I mean, I can't even imagine getting into that.
You would have to benefit the consumer first and foremost. I think what you do is you end run everybody else. So with all of DeFi, with all of these kind of applications, you really need to make it so that the consumer wants these things. And then the consumer will demand these things to either their legislators, they'll demand it to their hospitals, et cetera, right? Like, for example, smartphones came out. And now what? Like hospitals and clinics and whatever, they have like apps where you can check your lab work yourself now, right? That's pretty common. But that was, is that, was that demanded by consumers? Was that something that the technology company said, hey, you know, we think we can market our product better if we have this availability? So I think like the solution is to target the consumer ultimately and skip all the other folks. And then if you create a good enough service, then what happens is those companies will adopt bringing that data into their, you know, into their stream. Like, for example, if you created a dApp that, you know, let's say kept a list of your, I don't know, meds and allergies on chain, right? And you have that tokenized information, it's encrypted. And only if you, Lucky, give your, you know, tokenized piece of information over to that hospital, they will be able to access it, right? So it would be no different than the encryption level that prevents people from, I don't know, like changing the parameters for Luna or something, right? Like it's going to have...
I mean, it's somewhat no different than me giving like my birth date, my SOSH and other things that are like key to like my private key, right? I mean,
exactly. Exactly.
It's the same thing.
So there's always a way to have that misused or go to the wrong people. But I think to the extent that like security versus convenience does become a problem, but it can be done. I think the consumer would prefer that to then what they're having to deal with now, which is like nobody knows what the hell is going on when they go to a hospital, right? Like, which is more common now, right? Like here you are, you're having your heart attack and you're like, you know, like they don't have your shit and you don't, you know, they don't know what, how many stents you've had in your heart and all that.
And they're asking for my insurance card when I'm on the table. I'm
like, right. You're laying there and they're trying to get your medical information while they're on the, exactly. So that's how the world works now. So I think the consumer or the patient or whoever is going to prefer this in the long run. It's like, it's just a matter of just building it right. And not only building it, but like having it adopted by, you know, other software platforms. Like, so you don't have to rework everything at one time. You can, it's just same as DeFi, right? It's all about composability. Like you have a person's allergy record is one, you know, dApp, and you have a person's med record is maybe another one, so that you could like compose the two, and like cross-reference them in some meaningful way, right? So
I don't know. Like the kind of stuff that I feel like NFTs and blockchain should be like used for. This is like the real use case.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's just data points, right? Like NFT is a non-fungible data point, and you know, then you have like a token or a coin that you can exchange with an expected valuation. It's like
I just think we're still like a couple generations away from it completely being technology driven 100%, right? I mean, I think we still have some generations that need to kind of pass on to the next life that then just grew
probably
up completely on technology.
Well, it's also just one implementation at a time, right? Like,
right.
You know, it's like now it looks like one thing, and then 10 years from now, you're like, wow, all this stuff is, you know, all these things have changed. And then 10 years from then, it's just like it, then it looks really obvious. Like, okay, what were they doing with payphones? You know, what were they doing with landlines? You know, like, it's moved pretty quick, actually, if you think about tech.
It really has. Like, everything's been happening within the past, like, 50 years or so.
I mean, think about just 2000 versus now, like, where the internet
Y2K,
was
then, baby. Versus now. Remember that?
Yeah, Y2K.
You'd be in the office, because when the computers were going to change, it was supposed to blow up.
nuclear Armageddon.
To put it into perspective, I was 2 years old during that.
Oh, my God. Internet.
Yeah, good times. Back in the old good days. Times.
2 years old. Yeah, you're about half my age then.
Yeah.
That's funny. Although we had the 80s were a good time though. I mean, we thought we were all gonna die of nuclear war, but it was still a really good time. Like,
oh, man.
That's what I keep saying, like the like the Stranger Things kids, that was us.
Yeah,
like that was me and my buddies.
With the nuclear conflict. That's the best part of the century.
Yeah, it's like the song from Alphaville, "Forever Young." It's like the, you know, it's like the sphere of nuclear Armageddon in the background. But hey, we'll be all right. It's like kind of now, actually, with
you
know, war with Russia. And, you know, it's, oh shit.
Yeah. Oh man.
Anyway, guys, it's been fun. I've got to hit work tomorrow morning, so I was just like.
Yeah, I gotta get off. All right, I'll see you guys. Take a look at that thing I just sent you. Can you just read it real quick for me?
Yeah, I'm looking.
Look one: the king, the triangle, the sun, and a large cap.
No. I DM'd it to you. It's a slide.
I was reading the post.
Oh, I was reading the post at the top.
Just take a look at it for me.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. All right,
see ya.
Lucky. I DM'd you, by the way, about the consulting stuff. So whenever you're free, I'm down to meet and talk about it.
Cool. All right. See you guys.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was the CeFi Space MMO War Stories, recorded on Thursday, March 31st, 2022. This episode of The Ether was brought to you by Glow Yield. Glow Yield is the ecosystem of Terra decentralized apps like Lotto and Creators, all powered by DeFi Yields. Glow Creators helps artists and influencers give their fans exclusive perks through membership, NFTs, and more. Glow Lotto is a PrizeLink savings account with a weekly chance to win the big jackpot. Tickets are free and perpetual, which means there's zero chance to lose money. Be sure to follow Glow Yield on Twitter and join the Discord community to stay up to date with all the glowing projects, and check them out online at glowyield.com. This episode of The Ether was also brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening. Waking up like a basement dweller, stepped out the door and heard racists yelling. 2020, what an ugly shit show. Staring at the fucking Rickroll from the get-go. Looking outside, the whole state's on fire. The fuck do you expect when you embrace the liars and replace the writers with AI just like us? Emaciated models killing bright birds. First in, last out, picture me rolling. The worst time to cash out, so what you holding? The Merc's gonna cash cow, country stolen. Drooling over chicken like the goose is golden. Trying to be soulful, spitting that molten lava from the bottom of the caldera. I'm hot and gonna put it in a bottle and offer it to the god who hit the gas full throttle, blasting off in a rocket.
The many people who will see things happen to them that are in their favor. So someone's looking over me. That's a fascinating phenomenon when that happens. And when you analyze those situations, what you find is that we as humans simply have a profound inability to understand statistics and probability.
Stitching these writings, living that life like, who would have guessed you turn out this nice, right? Avoiding stress, that's the motherfucking secret. Print that shit on a motherfucking leaflet. I'm just an asshole hooked on the bricks. Looking at the rectangles, damn, they kinda thick. We've gone through a whole lot of kings here. Cutting off heads just to bring cheer. Getting all fired up, Tiger King, line them up. When you'd give an arm and a leg just to try the junk on some first time buyer's luck. Alexa, set a reminder and remind me to buy a bunch. And put your hands up if you fuck this year. And keep them in the air if you're picking up the spare. And put your mask on just to go outside. Looking at the planet about to downsize.
So climate change will not make Earth I live in New York City, where in our harbor we have the Statue of Liberty. If you melt the water ice that's on land, the ocean level will rise to reach her left elbow. That takes out all of New York City. And basically every other coastal city that we've spent thousands of years building since the dawn of civilization.
Terra Spaces.